Later on in the program, we're going to be talking to opera lecturer Desiree Mays about Parsifal, the quest for the Holy Grail. I'm very happy now to welcome to the program John Davis. He is Poet Laureate of Santa Fe, and he is the director of the MFA program in creative writing at the Institute of American Indian Arts. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Oh, thank you. Good to be here.
Great to have you back on the show. Now, ladies and gentlemen, if you didn't know that there was an MFA program in creative writing at the Institute of American Indian Arts, that's because it's only being announced today.
Today we become official. And so I'm on the radio.
Telling people about it.
Yeah, up till now it's been a bit of a secret. I mean, it's out there, and we have to say, every time we talk about it, we have to say pending approval by the final approval by the Higher Learning Commission. So we still have to say that, but we'll know today.
So what is this? It's called a low residency MFA in creative writing, which means that you don't have to basically move to Santa Fe or move to a dorm and live there for 2 years.
That's right. There are about 50 or so low residency MFA programs in the country. The oldest and best known being Vermont College and Warren Wilson back east. I think there's about 12 or 15 of us now west of the Mississippi. Most of them are east.
Right.
And the motto is you come for a week, and it's like a writing festival for a week. The faculty come in, we have visiting writers, visiting editors, agents, etc. We have workshops in the morning, we have craft lectures in the afternoon, we have readings every night by faculty. And you do that for a week, and then you kind of petition to study with whoever is the person you think you'll study best with, work best with. And then you work one-on-one for 16 weeks.
Remotely,
online with that person, whoever you end up with.
So that's a very interesting thing, because there's a presumably mutual matchmaking that goes on between the students and the faculty.
Right. Midweek, the students are working in workshop, and they're listening to readings and craft lectures from the various writers. And then towards the end of the week, they get a chance to sit down and interview each of the teachers to see who they want to study with, who might be the best match for them. And then they apply to study with that person. And for example, Sherman Alexi will be teaching for us, and I'm sure there'll be a lot of people who apply to study with Sherman, so it'll be
right.
A little bit competitive. But it'll be more about the right match for the right person at the right time.
That's interesting. Now, what would constitute a good match? So if somebody has the kind of wit that Sherman Alexi has, you might match them with it?
Oh, no, we wouldn't let two wits in the same room. I don't think there's a, you know, I haven't done this yet.
Yeah.
You know, I've talked to people who have done it, and so it's a bit of a mystery still to me, and I think I won't know exactly how it works until we sit down to actually do it.
Very, yeah. Very cool. Now, are all the people who are going to be students in this, do you have to be a Native American person?
No. I mean, obviously, it's our mission to promote Native culture, promote Native writers, and to attract and recruit Native students.
Yeah.
But so we want a majority. But it's also, as all our programs are, open to everyone.
Right.
You know, we will... We have a kind of mandate to study Native literature in the grad program, so they also read books while they're studying, and about a quarter of those in most genres will be Native books and books written by Native writers. So there's that, and that's it's an important part of the decision-making process for someone coming to this school, that they want to read that literature and be part of that community.
Or maybe they're already deeply immersed in it and want to explore it further.
Right. And that's what happened to me. I mean, that's why I teach at the Institute of American Indian Arts. When I was finishing up my graduate program at the University of Montana, Joy Harjo, the famous Creek poet, Muscogee poet, was a visiting writer for a semester. And she started me thinking about Native literature, reading Native literature. I found out about the Institute of American Indian Arts there, and eventually circled my way around and ended up here.
Very interesting. Now, were you at one of those low residency programs?
No, I was at the old-fashioned
high
high residency
high res
high res program. Yeah, at the University of Montana. So.
Now, what kind of qualifications do students need to get into this program? They presumably have to have some kind of pretty decent writing portfolio.
Right. The writing portfolio is the most important thing. We require a bachelor's degree in some subject. Doesn't have to be writing. And it's possible, although it will be rare, that someone who just had amazing writing skills could be accepted into the program. That happens occasionally.
Yeah.
In all the MFA programs. But it will be rare. So it's mostly the writing. I mean, when someone applies, we will look at the writing first, and that will be a huge part of our decision-making process.
How many students do you have every, what is the time scale, every year, every 2 years?
We're going to go with kind of a cohort model. So right now, at least, our idea is that we're not going to accept students in the spring. It'll only be the fall, which is technically this summer, July 28th. It'll always be the end of July, the beginning of August, when we have the one week residency. So we're going to accept 25 to 30, I'm hoping 30, students for the first cohort. And then, again, in the second year, we'll accept for the summer another 30, so we'll have 60 total. And it'd be great to have 60 because it means more professors, more students, a bigger mass, more excitement.
Now, you have all your faculty in place already?
I do, yeah. They're all lined up. The way the program works is that the students have to take three different faculty over the course of 2 years. So we have a fairly large pool of faculty to choose from. Right now, I think there are 14 faculty that I have ready to come and teach, depending on the number of students.
In a program like that that's low residency, so people then go back home to wherever they live and continue doing their jobs. Now, how does the communication work? I mean, you work online, but do you have a kind of weekly date? Or, you know, how do you do it?
It's the work itself, the creative work, the writing, generally comes in most programs some are every other week, but most of the time it's every 4 weeks in a 16-week semester. The student will send work to the mentor, faculty mentor, and then the mentor will send comments back pretty quickly, within 5-7 days. And then often there's a Skype or a phone conversation after that. And that's the creative work. On the reading side, it's up to the individual professor, but it will be at least the fiction writers want to teach 8 books a semester, one every 2 weeks. And some of the poets are out of control and want to teach 40 books a semester. So it'll be at least 8. It'll be less than 40.
We're talking to John Davis, Poet Laureate of Santa Fe, about the new MFA program in creative writing at the Institute of American Indian Arts. It's so interesting. You and I had a conversation years ago about how, I mean, before the 1960s, there was some African-American writing, there was some Native American writing, the sort of ethnic studies existed, but really began to flourish in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, and the quality of writing from all of these so-called, whatever, minority ethnic communities has gotten so good.
Oh, I totally agree, yeah. I'm a huge fan of the current crop of African-American poets. When I first started this program, I thought, well, it'll be a mixed faculty. I didn't know if I could get enough people who were free to teach who were all Native. And it turns out that 85% of the faculty are Native. I think there's 3 non-Native, 1 screenwriter, because the few screenwriters out there are all in demand and working very hard. They're all also directors, and so they're making movies all the time, so it's difficult to get screenwriters.
Yeah.
So there's 1 non-Native screenwriter. And then creative nonfiction is a more slowly developing field. For historical reasons, I think.
Because it's just a newer genre?
It's a newer genre, and there's also been a history of suspicion of kind of revealing yourself, your culture, your place in the culture, all the things that we expect of memoir, I think, have been difficult, and only just coming around to grappling with that. So there's fewer nonfiction writers.
And is there a big difference between memoir and creative nonfiction?
Memoir falls within the creative nonfiction genre, but there's all sorts of you know, various ways to approach creative nonfiction. Doesn't necessarily have to be revealing yourself.
But it kind of usually is, isn't it?
Kind of usually is. Well, the self is at the center of creative nonfiction always.
Yeah.
Because it's your voice speaking.
So you've got poetry, fiction, nonfiction, creative nonfiction, and screenwriting.
Screenwriting, those are
the,
right.
That's the whole range.
Right. And the screenwriting was a little bit of a surprise. I did some surveying of potential audience to see whether it would be playwriting, screenwriting. I had young adult, which may still be an area that we look into, because Sherman Alexie, of course, has had real success in that area.
Young adult fiction.
Right, and others have too who are on staff, so it may turn out.
And you read his young adult fiction, and then you just feel like you're just reading fiction.
Right, yeah, it's... Yeah.
Yeah. It's really good.
Yeah, emphasis on the adult.
Yeah,
in that phrase. I'd like to just name my faculty.
Sure.
I was about to go on sabbatical when we had a visit from the Higher Learning Commission, and we were going to start this program in August of 2014, and the committee that came to evaluate the program were so excited they told the president, "Well, we love this program, but we think you should start it in 2013. So I postponed my sabbatical to do this program. And one of the reasons was I was excited about the possibility of putting together a faculty that was really cooperative, that was hardworking. And all these faculty members I knew personally, and I'd also seen them work at our school, almost all of them, with our student body. And so it's really exciting for me to put the faculty together, and maybe that's the reason why I postponed my sabbatical most, was to kind of assemble this faculty. So we have Sherman Alexie.
Yay.
You all know Sherman Alexie. We have Sherwin Bitsui, who graduated from the Institute of American Indian Arts, has gone on to do two books and has read and taught everywhere.
Nice.
Amanda Boyden, a novelist whose first book was Pretty Little Dirty, which was a gigantic seller.
Good title.
Yeah, it's a good book. It's about a young woman. The whole book is small sections centered around different punk rock shows that she went to. So it's a really interesting book. Each one has the title of the band that she was going to. Of course, it's fiction, not memoir.
Right.
Joseph Boyden, who just won the Giller Prize in Canada, for basically the Pulitzer of Canada for his most recent novel. And most people know him from a novel called 3 Day Road, which is a gigantic international bestseller.
Now, Joe Boyden and Amanda Boyden, are they related?
They are married.
Okay.
Yeah.
Two novelists. Nice.
Yeah, and they've both come to our school kind of supported by one of those landing grants we get, and spent a lot of time with our students, and I saw them working as a team or separately. They both work great. I also stayed with them in New Orleans, and I noticed the first thing they got up when I was there, they flipped open their laptops and they started doing work with students online. So I saw that and I thought,
yeah,
that's what we want.
Yep.
And then Natalie Diaz, who was here recently, read for the Lannan Foundation, and she just won a Lannan Literary Award. She's a poet. And I'm actually writing an article today about her work in language recovery with the Mojave tribe where she's from. She's director of that program. So that's interesting. And then quickly, I'll go through the rest. Melissa Phoebus, who's a New Yorker. I wanted a little cosmopolitan edge to the program.
That's important.
Yeah.
So a lot of urban people.
Right, to see both sides. And she's non-native, but she's... But she's been really great, really, of all the faculty, the most enthusiastic. Well, they're all enthusiastic. I shouldn't say most. Equally enthusiastic. Santee Frazier, another graduate of IAIA. Sterling Harjo, filmmaker, who's going to teach screenwriting for us.
And now, is Sterling related to Joy Harjo?
I don't know the answer to that.
Okay.
I don't think so, but he could be. I could be wrong. But he's a young, kind of really energetic filmmaker. He's been at Sundance twice with two different features, and so that's exciting.
Yeah.
Jeff Harris, who teaches Latino workshops and Native American workshops for ABC and NBC, has Joan Kane, who just won the AWP, the Associated Writing Program's first book award, poetry book award. Chip Livingston, another person who can teach fiction, nonfiction, poetry, does everything. Susan Power, who's grass dancer, is well known. A Canadian novelist named Eden Robinson. And then Orlando White, who also graduated from the Institute.
And you.
And me. I won't be a faculty mentor as my title, but there'll always be a few people who may not fit in, or we may have six poets, and each mentor is kind of limited to five students maximum.
Okay.
And if that were the case, I'd probably pick up the sixth one, things
right.
like that.
So this all starts, how do people apply?
There are, if you get on the website, the IAIA website, that's IAIA.edu. And if you go to academics, there's a drop-down menu. You'll see the MFA in creative writing there. And there's an online application, and there's instructions on materials and how to get them to us. And you can read about the faculty there and read about how the program works.
One of the things that this whole new program makes me think about is when you talk about cultural dominance and people who are kind of oppressed cultures, part of the reason that one group dominates in, say, literary fields is because they've got MFA programs,
right.
because they've got education, because they've got mentors. And right. when you actually give those tools to any group in the world, they flourish.
Right. And that's why I'm so excited about this program, is that, you know, for the first time, you can go to a graduate program where you're learning from other native writers.
Yeah.
You know, there's basically, the way I think of it is, there's basically 500 plus tribes in the country, and they're all basically sovereign nations, and students always have to go abroad to study creative
you're
writing.
Kidding.
I mean, that's the way I think of it.
Oh, you know? Abroad meaning right
yeah,
to the United,
to the United States.
States.
Yeah. And so in this program, you know, if you're going to come to this program as a non-native, and maybe that's one way to think about it, you know, going abroad.
Yeah. If you're non-native, right. you're going abroad. And if you're native,
you can stay home. Or a kind of home.
Stay, yeah, basically yeah. home. Very interesting.
Yeah.
John Davis, so you are poet laureate, and you were doing not only this work at the Institute of American Indian Arts, but you're also doing all kinds of things as poet laureate, and one of them is on Sunday, March 24th in El Dorado. You are hosting a group of poets, and everybody's reading.
Right. This is the first of a series of readings I'm going to do, and I'll be reading with Dana Levin, poet who teaches at Santa Fe University of Art and Design, Gabe Gomez, who is actually the public relations director at St. John's, I guess now. But he just had his second book of poetry come out.
Yeah.
Anjo Bob Daniel Davila, who has a chapbook coming out with Salt Press very soon, and is a graduate of the Institute of American Indian Arts. And then Debbie Casillas, a poet that I work with individually, and her poems have started to appear in magazines all over.
And you and
me.
All of you will be reading at the performance space at La Tienda in El Dorado, and there's a very tiny suggested reading, but nobody will be turned away. So that is on Sunday, March 24th at 3:00.
Mm.
And would you like to read a poem before we go?
Yeah, I have a chapbook coming out with Q Avenue Press called Thelonious Sphere. It's a sequence of poems about Thelonious Monk, or responding to Thelonious Monk's life and music. And I'll read the last poem in the chapbook, and it's called Blue Monk. Blue Monk. Nobody knows where the music is taking us. The head anchors us against chaos. The piano's contradictions, pithy asides. The sax growls, then turns sweet, then dips down to chide the rhythm section. The drummer dropping bombs or skipping, now jaunty and joyful, the piano gone. Monk sips a drink or just waits, his eyes closed, dreaming or scheming away, in without a plan save slipping from this cord to the next, surfacing like a river otter, now here, now there, now here, diminishments and augmentations, leaving thick tracks, then scuffling light-footed over wet ground, high hat and the bass's querulous solo, outraged Monk bursts back into the now.
John Davis, poet laureate here in Santa Fe and director of the MFA program in creative writing at the Institute of American Indian Arts, which is on the web at iaia.edu. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
I'm very happy now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Desiree Mays. She is an international opera lecturer. She is a speaker during the Santa Fe opera season about the various operas. And this Thursday, the 28th of February, at 1 o'clock at St. John's Methodist Church, she will be giving a talk called Parsifal, The Quest for the Holy Grail. Welcome.
Hello, Mary Charlotte. It's lovely to be back.
It's
must
great
be spring.
To have you. It must be spring. I know. It's like, it's not opera on it's not your book
yet. It's not
yet.
Opera. No, it's the other opera.
Yeah. So, and what we're talking about, actually, Parsifal is an advance of the Saturday, March 2nd, high-definition screening of Parsifal at the Lenzic Performing Arts Center here in Santa Fe. That's at 10 in the morning. I think it's quite sold out, though.
Yes, it probably is. They're not doing the repeat because it's a six-hour epic. You're there for the day. It starts at 10. You'll get out at 4.
No.
So they can't do
Richard
it twice.
Richard Wagner wrote these. What was he thinking?
He thought
he's
long.
Keeping you sitting there for 6 hours.
Actually, the piece is not six. It's about 4.5. But by the time you do two long intermissions to give the singers time to catch their breath or whatever.
I mean, you have to give them lunch.
Well, that's what they do, of course, Mary Charlotte, in the big theaters. And in Bayreuth, it's a very long intermissions. You have your first course and the first. And that's actually a great way to go to the opera. Because I promise you, once you get into the space of this piece and these long pieces, you're there forever, it seems. And yet, it's no time at all. There's actually a line in Parsifal that says, here, time stands apace. And the response is, time and space are one. And that's the way I think you need to go to an opera like Parsifal. You need to give up time. And actually, personally, when I went to see Lohengrin recently, that was also very long. It wasn't long enough. You know, coming back to reality after 6 hours was tough. I was quite happy where I was.
Yeah. So let's talk about Parsifal as a story. What are the origins of this story are like medieval?
Yeah, actually way beyond medieval. The story goes back into the mists of Celtic time, actually. So it's a little hard to ever pinpoint what is the origin of Parsifal, because there are many, many, depending on which books you read. I mean, it does go back, we know, to the 12th century, where the tales of the Grail were told. And actually the story is, across the board, pretty well based in the court of Arthur. The Arthurian tales, the Knights of the Round Table, and what were the criteria for being knights, what were the knights all about. But with King Arthur, for instance, there's one tale that does dip back into Celtic times, where they all go off to a place in Wales to find this cauldron, which is sort of the precursor of the Holy Grail. And it's a very special magic cauldron that's guarded by 9 beautiful maidens, and whoever has is fed or drinks from the cauldron has magical powers and the gift of prophecy and all these wonderful things, which is pure myth and Celtic myth at that. So there is already sort of a little disconnect, if you like, between Celtic myth and the Arthurian court. But here they all blend together. Wagner based his version on the story by Wolfram von Eschenbach, a good German writer who wrote Parzival, P-A-R-Z-I-F-A-L. And that really is one of the major sources of this opera. He drew from many other sources, of course, as well. And I think we have to remember that Wagner was his own librettist. So in this case,
yeah,
you know, where he writes the story, he does everything. He does, and that was unusual in his time. You nearly always collaborated with a librettist and they wrote the story and you worked with that, but he didn't do that.
Well, you still do, don't you?
Yes, of of course. Well, not of course. I mean, typically, yes, there's a librettist. The new opera we're doing this summer, for instance, at the Santa Fe Opera, has a librettist and a composer, and they work very closely together. Not with Wagner, which is probably just as well, because he wasn't the easiest person to work with. And right. He had thought about this story for about 20 years. He seemed to think about, have ideas, and then they sort of vegetated. And in the interim, he wrote The Ring, Tristan and Isolde, Die Meistersingers, and so it was sort of germinating before he got to the story. But it is basically an Arthurian tale. It's there's no King Arthur in this. It's Percival, who was Sir Percival in the court of Arthur. And in Arthur's court, the leading quest, perhaps, was the quest for the Holy Grail.
Now, let's talk about that. What is the Holy Grail? What does it mean? What's the deep symbolism underneath it?
Yeah, that's what I'm going to be talking about
this.
We'll give us a hint. 2 hours. I'll give you a hint. The Holy Grail can be whatever you want it to be. Now, Wagner himself said that, yes, the Holy Grail was the chalice that was at the Last Supper. It was the chalice that was used is now used, of course, for the Eucharist. It's also considered to be the chalice, the cup into which the blood of Christ fell during the crucifixion, and that Joseph of Arimathea had taken this cup to some other place after Jesus' death. It could be in Ravello, it could be in the vaults of the Vatican. Wagner places it in Montsalvat, which is the high Pyrenees in northern Spain. So there are many places where the real cup, in quotes, could be. And of course, this cup would be considered sacred by any standards. So that's one interpretation. But there are many. Going back to the pre-Celtic times, as I mentioned, it could often be a stone. It would be something that would nurture the people who could partake of magical food or drink from it. In our time, it can be nothing at all, or everything. It's the goal at the end of the quest, and if you think of, I mean, we all quest through lives, through our lives. When we're young and teenagers, perhaps we don't even realize there is a path that's going to take us through our lives. For each and every one of us, it'll be different. We'll have different goals, but when that path becomes clear, and when one has a goal, a special goal, and in this case, it's the quest for the Holy Grail, what does that mean? Now, Joseph Campbell, of course, took this up. This was a big issue of his, and he said that the quest for the Grail, if you think of it, is just the goal at the end of the road. There's that marvelous film, Indiana Jones and the Quest for the Grail, and when he finally...
One of the most stupid comic book films ever made in the history of the universe.
But again, it's the same story. The story is the same for all of us. I mean, he finds the Grail, and he's asked, "What did you find?" And the answer's wonderful. He says... illumination. So there's one good thing there. You know, that's something maybe what we achieve. Are we seeking enlightenment? In terms of Buddhism, there's a lot of Buddhists connects in this opera. That's quite clear that Wagner went way beyond just the Christian interpretation, that there is this Buddhist interpretation. And even he uses Schopenhauer, who was his great guru, I think, for Wagner. What does it mean? What is it that we quest after?
Well, and it's such a tricky thing because, I mean, certainly the Buddhist version, but all of these things are so riddled with paradox because you never get to an end where you seek and find and have and you're done. It doesn't really work like that, no, even if you think it does.
No, there's something beyond, of course. And this is another good example here with Joseph Campbell. He said there are three stages to the quest, regardless of what the quest is. There's separation, initiation, and return. Now, in terms of Parsifal, the way that works is that Parsifal appears out of the forest, a young, ignorant boy. He is parentless, it seems. He had a mother, but she's died. He's come from nowhere. He knows nothing. He is a blameless fool. The one line that I think really gives the answer to this entire opera is the line that says, "The pure fool made wise through compassion." So at the beginning, he's nothing but a fool, and he stumbles into this place, the land of the Holy Grail, where there are all these knights who venerate the Grail, and he's done something unforgivable. He's taken his bow and arrow, and he's shot a swan. And in this part of the world, you do not shoot swans. They're sacred beings. So he's told off for that. And Gunnemans, who throughout the whole of this opera is a sort of a fatherly figure. He's the wise sage. He's the connect between the real world and the maybe illusory world of the Grail, which may or may not exist. It's not available to anyone. And only those, the chosen, can find or reach the Grail. And we'll talk about that. So he blunders into this situation, literally, and kills a swan. He's told off about it. And then he observes strange things. There's a king who is in terrible pain. He has a wound in his side that will not heal. His name is Amfortas. And he is hoping for a cure. People come with Sir Gawain, one of the knights of the Round Table, goes to the four corners of the earth to find a cure, but nothing works. There's a wild woman who shows up called Kundry. She has come with a balsam. This doesn't work either. The wound will not heal, and Amfortas knows. He knows that, again, this line, that he will only be cured by the pure fool who is made wise through compassion. And we're beginning to get a sense that this may well be Parsifal, especially if you've seen it before. So the boy watches this incredible ritual of the Holy Grail, which is revealed to the knights. And it does provide them with sustenance. It keeps them going. In many productions, when the chalice is lifted, the whole thing glows red. And he sees this, but he doesn't get it. And Gunnemans is a bit upset, and he says, well, you've seen this. What did you get out of it? And he sort of says, I don't know. It doesn't mean anything to me. And Gunnemans throws him out of the palace, and he is cast out. So here is that first stage, as Joseph Campbell described it, as separation. He's been exposed to the possibility that there is something, there's something great at the end of the road. There is something to be achieved. If you call it a grail, enlightenment, nirvana, it doesn't really matter. But he is cast out, and he begins to quest. That's the first act. It's a very long first act. It's 2 hours in which Gunnemans tells a lot of story. There's wonderful storytelling in Wagner always. He gives you a lot of back history and then he repeats it to make sure we get it. In the second act, then, Parsifal finds himself in the land of Klingsor. Klingsor is a bad knight. Klingsor had wanted to be a knight of the Round Table at the Grail Castle, but he had been forbidden entrance, so to speak, because he was seen as not worthy. So in order to make himself worthy, he castrates himself, thinking, well, I'm now pure, I can be part of the Grail Crest, but he's told, no, that's not acceptable either. So he turns against...
So he gets pretty mad.
He gets pretty mad. He gets really mad, and what he has learned with this terrible act is that he has power of magic. So he conjures up this amazing castle out of nothing, out of the desert, and he fills it with really beautiful women whose job is to seduce any passing knight, because the more knights of the Grail he can control, his chances of getting the chalice, the Great Grail, are increased. So this is what's happening, and it turns out, of course, that in the past Amfortas had gone to this place, had been seduced, and as a result, he had been wounded in his side by the Holy Spear. Now, the Holy Spear is the other part of the Grail, the chalice, and there are really two parts that have now been separated. The Holy Spear was the spear that Amfortas took with him to Klingsor's magic garden, but he was wounded by the spear, the wound that never heals, and Klingsor now has the spear. Mm. So when Parsifal arrives, he knows nothing about this. He's still pretty klutzy. And he goes in and he's surrounded by flower maidens. This is usually done with a sort of near-naked group of ladies who do everything in their power to seduce them. And he's blown away.
Yeah, maiden in quotation marks.
Yeah, you know where Wagner got that idea? It's really wonderful. He was at a pantomime in England of Mother Goose at some Christmas time. And the dancing chorus, the ladies of the chorus, were flower maidens. So he thought, this is a good idea. I'll put these into the opera. So here are the flower maidens. Though in the current production that the Met is showing on Saturday, it's a different form of flower maidens. These are women who stand, very statuesque women, who stand frozen in the garden, holding each one a spear. And it's not until Parsifal arrives and Klingsor awakens them that they become the seductive women in the music. So they do everything to seduce him, and he's a little intrigued by all of this. But then they start fighting amongst themselves as to who's going to get him. And he says, stop. This is ridiculous. Stop. And there's a voice voice, a sound. It's a call, Parsifal, his name. And he turns, and who is it but Kundry, the woman we met in the first act as the wild penitent. Now she appears as this incredibly beautiful woman who calls him by his name. The name he really didn't know, but she tells him that Parsifal means pure fool. Parsi in Arabic is pure, and Fal is fool, the name he had been given as an infant. So she comes to him and she says that she has watched him grow as a child. She saw his mother who loved him and that his mother has died. So he's absolutely heartbroken. His mother is dead. He didn't know. He feels he's abandoned her. So Kundry at that moment takes on the role of all women, of mother, sister, beloved, betrothed, wife, everything. At this point she says, I have to give you from your mother a kiss. And just as she's about to kiss him in a way that no mother should or would kiss her son, he gets it. The flash goes off. There's this wonderful light of illumination. And he realizes what this whole thing is about. He somehow knows that the wound of Amfortas came from this very situation and he must resist her. And he does. He keeps her at arm's length. He said, I understand now. I understand the wound. And he takes on that suffering. He identifies totally with Amfortas, which is what, again, back to the first line, pure fool made wise by compassion. He now understands and feels empathy and pain for Amfortas and keeps her at length. Her response is quite wonderful. She said, well, if you suddenly got it by my kiss, think what would happen if you spent the night in my arms, you'd become a god. But he resists.
That's a good line.
It is. It doesn't work. He resists her, and she is so furious that she calls Klingsor, who appears, the mighty evil knight, holding the holy spear, which he hurls at Parsifal. But the spear knows better. It comes to Parsifal. It rests above his head,
not
in his heart. And he
grabs it.
And he takes it very reverentially. And he makes a blessing, the sign of the cross, with it. And the entire castle disappears. This is really great for directors. You know, the whole thing just collapses into nothing. And Parsifal now has the spear. So that's the second act, not quite as long as the first, but there's a lot of drama in this act. And so that's the second stage too. Going back to Joseph Campbell, we're talking about initiation. He now has had that flash of light. He has done what the Buddha did. He went out and he experienced all sorts of terrible events. He's really tested in this and in the following years as he tries to find his way back to the Grail Castle, because he knows he needs to bring the spear back and that he can heal Amfortas.
We're talking to Desiree Mays about Parsifal, the quest for the Holy Grail. So what's stage three?
Stage three, then, is return to the castle. It is literally called Return. And in the wonderful stories of the great mystics, and even in the story of the Buddha, when he finds enlightenment, I think of Teresa of Avila, when she has these incredible visions, the temptation for the mystic is to stay in that place of bliss. And they often die at that point. They remain in this wonderful space and die. But the hope is, which again, the Buddhist influence here, is that he will go back and he will take what he has learned back to the Grail Castle. He will heal the king and the community. And that for any of us who are on a sacred path, a path to higher understanding, if and when we achieve some of these levels, it's almost a responsibility to take it back and share. Now, if the rest of the world live like that, Marichard, I mean, I think there's a very relevant message in this.
Yeah.
That if we can, I mean, I know every time I watch the news, it's so heartrending. One's heart goes out to the suffering, the children you see suffering out there. You have this incredible empathy to them, and you want to do something about it. And so many people do. And if more people did, that's exactly what this opera is about. It's made wise through compassion and taking on that suffering. In a Buddhist form, he puts off his own bliss by going back and attempting to heal the king and the people, the community, and by extension, the rest of the world, by what he has learned. So in the final act, he goes back. He arrives back on Good Friday, and Gonamans meets him, and Kundry, who is now a penitent. Again, she is sort of crawling in the underworld, and she's torn. Kundry has her own wonderful story. Kundry lived at the time of Christ, and when he passed her in the street carrying the cross, she laughed at him. And then his eyes met hers, and she knew that she was going to be condemned, cursed, to live forever because of this laugh, because she had laughed at the Savior. She would have to expiate that sin, karma, straight karma, over and over again. So her life cycle is to, when Klingsor awakens her and forces her to seduce a knight, when she does, she then falls back into the role of the penitent. But she's trapped. There's no way she can get out of this terrible cycle until, of course, Parzival comes along and redeems her by not succumbing to her. So they're there, and they all tell one another their stories as to what's happened. And Gudemann said, well, I'll take you to the Grail Castle, but things are very bad. The old king has died. Amfortas refuses to show the Grail, and they are dying. Parzival says, well, take me there. And they invest him. I mean, there's great Christian symbolism. At one point, Mary Magdalene anoints his feet with her hair, which, of course, is a straight Christian symbolism of the week of the suffering. And they go to the Grail Castle. Parzival touches Amfortas on his side. He is healed. He takes the Holy Grail, and the heavenly voices rejoice as the opera ends. So it has a happy, long ending, and it's an amazing piece of music. It's actually, the story at this level is sort of lightly handled, but it happens at many, many levels. It's a very rich piece. And personally, and this is always true of opera, it's about the music. If you just sit and listen to that music, you will understand a lot of what Wagner intended, I think,
right,
in the music.
It's so intertwined with the nature of the music.
With nature, and the story itself is so complex. What is he trying to achieve? I don't know that he himself had any real idea of the implication and the extraordinary effect this opera would have. He did want it performed only at Bayreuth. He reviewed this as a... if not as a sacred piece, but as a piece that you went to in a sort of meditative state, if you like. People don't applaud at the end of Parsifal at Bayreuth. And when
really?
They don't. There's no applause. It's like a church ceremony. I mean, you go, you live through the whole thing, and there is no applause at the end. And Wagner insisted he wanted this only to be performed at Bayreuth. And when he died, he actually died 6 months after this, after the premiere of this opera. He had a Jewish conductor that he didn't want. The whole anti-Semitic issue of Wagner and the Jews is something, you know, I will not get into. But in this case, he had a Jewish conductor that he had a sort of ongoing battle with. And at the last performance, Wagner apparently went into the pit at Bayreuth, and he took the baton from Hermann Levi, the conductor, and he conducted the final act. Apparently, it was transforming for everyone who was there, including Hermann Levi, who reported this. It was the 16th performance of the opera, and Wagner died 6 months after that. He never conducted another orchestra. So it really is the very end of his career, and something a magnificent work that he completed. But then Cosima was in charge, his wife, of Bayreuth, and she absolutely insisted nobody else could do it. But in 1903, the Met decided they were going to do a pirated version, and she sued them up and down everywhere, but couldn't do it because of this was this. She's in Germany and the Met's in America, so they did a sort of a pirated performance then. And it's a really popular piece whenever it comes. And the current production is quite wonderful, mainly because of its extraordinary. No, I've seen clips of it, and I have to wait until Saturday to see it. I haven't seen it yet, but the singer, I've heard it. The singers in this production are quite extraordinary. It's as good as you're, I suppose, ever going to get. That's worthwhile. The sets, however, are something else. Should we talk a little about these, the sets?
Sure.
Typically, you have the Grail Castle, then the Magic Garden, and then back to the Grail Castle. In this set, it's a real wasteland. The entire stage is a great wasteland with a sort of a river running through the middle of it. And they do something quite extraordinary in the second act. Instead of a flower garden, in the second act, this stream in the middle of the stage turns to blood. So it is as if everybody in that second act has actually entered the wound of Amfortas. So everything swims in blood in that second act, which has to be staggering. I mean, the impact must be quite amazing. So we have to wait until Saturday to see that. And this is, I think, again, over the years, different directors have many different takes on this piece, what it all means.
Is it a normal thing? I mean, the Met first did it in the first part of the 20th century. They've been doing it regularly ever since?
Yes, yes. Then the time limitation ran out, and there was no way that Bayreuth could maintain control over this incredible work. So it's performed now all over the world. In fact, there's a major sort of swell of Wagnerian operas. The Ring is being performed all over the place. That's 16 hours of music and four nights. I mean, you commit a week of your life when you go to the Ring,
yeah.
Which is fine with people who are into it. There's a real addiction to this piece, and I understand it now. I mean, my husband Peter really did not want anything to do with Wagner or the Ring when I first met him, but he's always playing in the house, and he can actually pick out the themes now. He got up from the dinner table last night and said, oh, this is such and such a theme. You know, so the familiarity, I think, it helps with that, and the more you get to know the music, the more you want to know. You do come out of most of these performances maybe changed, transformed, transfigured. These are big words, but in a sense that one really has observed what the quest is about. And it's not just in this opera, it's the same in all of his operas. I mean, The Ring is one long quest from the beginning to the end, wresting something from nature, putting it through all these various tests, and finally returning it to nature to make things whole in that wonderful cyclical way of life that we're still trying to achieve.
Well, and there's also, it's such an interesting question about the power of art, because when you watch somebody else having a quest, it's not really the same thing as doing it yourself.
Mm.
And yet you're saying you kind of come out transformed. So there's something of that quest that you get as an audience member.
Yes, you do, on two different levels. One is the intellectual one, I suppose, where you're following the story and you recognize the fights, you know, the fight with the dragon. But the dragon doesn't have to be a fire-breathing dragon. It's an obstacle in your path that you have to get past in order to get to the next stage. The rescuing of damsels in distress, or in these days, the damsels who are rescuing the knights who get who get into trouble. All of this, these tests are placed before us before we can achieve something. The main message comes from the music, always from the music. That's why I think you come out very different from the end of 6 hours of this music, and the resolution at the end is transformative. That certainly happens at the end of Tristan and Isolde. These two go through these terrible hours of longing for each other. In the last act, Tristan also is dying of a wound, and Isolde comes to him at the last moment and sings the great love death, the Liebestod. And by the end of that opera, in the resolution of those chords, it's quite an extraordinary experience. Same with The Ring. After 16 hours, the first time I saw The Ring, I was in the ladies' room afterwards, and after the 16 hours, and I'm listening to the ladies chatting, and the first thing I heard was one woman saying to another, that was so great, when can we do it again?
Oh my goodness.
Is that extraordinary? I mean, that's the way it is. I know people who have mortgaged their homes in order to be able to travel around the world to go to The Ring. The wonderful mentor I had, Sherwin Sloan, who's no longer with us, he gave up his job as an eye surgeon in Los Angeles in order to take tours to go to the Ring. He went to 96 Ring cycles.
Good heavens.
And sadly, he died on the 97th, which happened to be in his hometown in Los Angeles. So, you know, there's something amazing going on
here
with
this
music.
Well, maybe happily he died. I mean, that's the way
for
he
him,
lived.
Yep, he was quite happy to go. But so there's something very strange and wonderful here. And I can talk about it in a million different ways. Even in researching this, I mean, you never come to the end of it. I think it is what it needs to be for each and every individual. The music is listen to the music if you can, and if people want to come on Thursday, that would be great too. We'll do some more of this. Mm-hmm.
Desiree Mays is an international opera lecturer. She lectures before the operas during the Santa Fe opera season, which is coming up, and we'll talk about that in a moment. And she's giving a talk this Thursday, the day after tomorrow, at 1 o'clock at St. John's Methodist Church, called Parsifal, The Quest for the Holy Grail. And you and I will do our five-part series,
yes,
starting on Monday, the 27th of May, and going for 5 Mondays on the 5 operas of the Santa Fe Opera.
Absolutely. We start on Memorial Day, and it's an exciting season this year. We don't do Wagner here, which is sad.
No.
But
there's not enough oxygen in the entire state
reasons.
To do
That's
Wagner.
Right. And you need a very big orchestra and a very long time. But so there'll be no Wagner, but the season is very exciting this year, and we'll be talking at length on that starting Memorial Day.
Well, Desiree Mays, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.